ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
4, 3, 2, 1.
G'day, Dr. Carl here.
And lift off.
40 years on, we want to unpack the behind-the-scenes story of the Challenger disaster.
Obviously a major malfunction.
I saw it explode. I couldn't believe it.
Hear the whole story on our podcast, The Challenger Legacy, a new series of science fiction. Search for science fiction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, those long-promised Epstein files, the about 3.5 million pages now released to the public, with just extraordinary consequences now that they're spotlit, including that Epstein could have been a Russian agent.
It's hard to know where to start with this episode, but we're going to dive headfirst into the Epstein files. I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Welcome to Global Roaming. Yes, look, normally we spend some time putting some context around what we're going to talk about and hopefully making things more understandable and drawing you in. But these Epstein files have landed, and as people are looking at them and analysing, there's just so many permutations, so many consequences that are really, really significant, Hamish, aren't they? That it, you know, to try to cover them all is a really big ask.
Essentially, though, we're going to get straight to our guest. We could not have found a better person to speak to what's unfolding, in part because he knows Lord Mandelson, Lord Peter Mandelson, who is centre stage at the moment in some of these latest revelations. John Sopel, a British journalist, former North America editor for the BBC. You might know him from the newsagents. Occasionally he'd appear on Q&A as well. He's in Australia a fair bit because his son lives here. He also wrote a biography of Tony Blair, by the way, which you'll hear in this episode. So let's go. John, welcome to Global Roaming. You're actually in Australia, so we've timed this well.
Perfectly.
So listen, at the time of recording this conversation, Sir Keir Starmer is still the British Prime Minister. How long is he going to last?
I mean, just the fact that you are asking me that question shows just how mind-boggling this whole story about Epstein is. I mean, Keir Starmer has never met Jeffrey Epstein. Epstein has been dead for 6 years. And yet the shadow he casts in death could be costing Britain's duly elected Prime Minister just 18 months ago his job. And it seems unbelievable because of the appointment of Peter Mandelson as Britain's ambassador to Washington, even though it was known that he had links to Epstein. What people didn't know was just the extent of the relationship and the information, confidential, market-sensitive information that Mandelson was giving Epstein. And therefore, the question is, Starmer, what on earth were you thinking appointing this man to represent our interests in Washington, D.C.?
But, I mean, John, you yourself said, you know, with Peter Mandelson, you wrote a column about this, there's always a risk, a hint of jeopardy, a whiff of cordite. It's a beautiful term. But it was worth the try, given the unbelievably complicated person called Donald Trump who was entering the White House. So, I mean, was it worth the risk?
So, look, he was doing a good job as ambassador. He's a very skilled politician. When he turns on the charm, he can be magnetic. When he's rough with you, he's really rough. And I've had my own run-ins with Peter Mandelson over the years, and I know him very well. So he was doing a good job. But could Keir Starmer have ever imagined the extent of the relationship that he might have been receiving monies from Jeffrey Epstein? And Mandelson says, I can't recall whether I received $75,000 from Jeffrey Epstein. Well, Jerry, I've got to say, if you'd wired me $75,000, I think I'd remember it. And so you've got Mandelson in a position where he just told lie after lie and talk. And, you know, the circle around him and the circle in New Labour is very tight, and it still is, around Blair and the key people who were there at the time. And the language that those people are using, you know, betrayal, he's a liar, he's let us down. I think people are so shocked at what they have discovered.
But at the time, they seem to buy into the risk. This is what I'm finding so completely captivating about trying to work this out and how we apply it, you know?
I actually wonder whether it's worth, John, you explaining for listeners, because I reckon most Australians probably have never noticed who Peter Mandelson is. Lord Mandelson is a kind of, to our view of the UK, he's a bit of a side player, but, you know, having lived and worked in the UK, there's a bit of the kind of Frank Underwood from House of Cards about him. That's always been the name you hear described. Who is he? Why is he so kind of feared and revered all at once?
He's a complicated individual. I wrote a book on Tony Blair years ago, and he inscribed something in it along the lines of the Blairite before Blair. So the godfather of the New Labour movement. He would be the person, the eminence grise, who worked behind the scenes, who strategically knew what Labour needed to do to win elections. This is after years of Margaret Thatcher being the dominant politician in British politics, and then John Major takes over as Prime Minister from Margaret Thatcher, and Labour are still in opposition, and they are still losing elections. And Peter Mandelson was the one who said, not only do we need to modernise the image of the party, we need to be attracting many more middle-class people than we were traditionally doing. And so behind the scenes, he was the person who was setting the policy directives. He played a big role in getting Tony Blair elected as Labour leader. Tony Blair becomes Prime Minister. Mandelson gets a senior job, even though he's never been in government, as Minister without portfolio, and then has to resign because he has taken a big loan from the sugar daddy of Labour politics, this very wealthy guy called Geoffrey Robinson. And he hasn't declared it to anyone. I think he's then a business minister, and the department knew nothing about him having accepted a loan, and this is in, you know, the 1990s, of £373,000, so $750,000 Aussie dollars. And people are saying, what were you doing? And you can join the dots. Money, influence has always been Mandelson's fatal attraction, that he is brilliant, but he makes real big errors of judgment. And while he was without peer as an advisor to Blair on how Blair needed to position himself, what the message needed to be, how it needed to be addressed, whenever it came to communicating about himself, he was an idiot. And he's made mistake after mistake after mistake after mistake. And yet people think, oh, well, we'll give you one more try. We'll give you one more chance.
His defense, though, in relation to Epstein thus far, in terms of the sex crime allegations, is that he's gay and therefore not involved in any of this involving younger women, knew nothing about it. But the story is something altogether different now.
Oh, yeah, completely. So, you know, so look, he could say, I didn't see. I mean, Peter Mandelson, as I say, I know well. And before he did his first media interview, you know, his friends made clear to him that this was not a smart thing to do and that he needed to, you know, kind of really strike the right tone. And he said, it was nothing to do with me because I'm gay. Then said, you know, do you feel sorry for the women? He said, I'm not going to apologize for that. And then he had to apologize the next day. And I think Peter Mandelson thought, after he was sacked as ambassador, there was a chance to come back in some other position in public life. And it just was fanciful. And I think that Mandelson has made miscalculation after miscalculation. And the fact of the matter is that at the height of the financial crisis, when Peter Mandelson is the business secretary, he is de facto the deputy prime minister to Gordon Brown. He is giving market-sensitive advice to Epstein on asset sales that might take place. That's number one. Some would say that's an act of treachery. And I'm not using the word in a hyperbolic way. I just think, in a literal sense, giving secrets about your government that could affect financial markets,
which is going to Jamie Dimon, the head of JP Morgan.
They go to Jamie Dimon, the chief executive of JP Morgan. He then said the British government wanted to impose a tax on bankers' bonuses. This is after the financial crash where everyone on Main Street has lost their livelihoods, but on Wall Street, everyone is safe because they're too big to fail. And so the government wants to introduce tax on bankers' bonuses. Mandelson represents to the government, to Gordon Brown, quite fairly. There's a lot of unease in the banking community about this. But it didn't stop there. He went back to the banking community and says, what you need to do if you want to change this policy is lightly threaten the Chancellor and the Prime Minister. And sure enough, Jamie Dimon rings up Alistair Darling, who was then the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and says, you know, we're the biggest buyers of your government's debt. What would happen if we stopped buying it? And you think, this is unbelievable. So Mandelson is writing the script. So who is he working for?
Well, I mean, look, the point is this story, we didn't know where to start, because the other part of this story is that Epstein is now being, according to the Polish Prime Minister, this man Epstein, what is the heck is he? He could well be, and they believe, he's an agent of the Russians. And they, in these files, there are, I don't know, however many sort of references to Russia, to Putin, meetings with Putin.
So people essentially offering, Epstein offering access for people to the Kremlin.
To the Kremlin. And that this could be a classic, and, you know, Mandelson becomes just one part of this extraordinary story, which that this classic compromise has gone on, that there's probably quite a few people serving in positions around the Western world at the moment about whom the Russians have compromising information.
So what, the Epstein, the island, all of this stuff, the photographs... This is the theory. Passed on
to the Kremlin. And of course, you can't help but think, I don't think, that this impossibly difficult to understand shift by Donald Trump towards Russia, which is playing out in terms of negotiations with Ukraine, etc., etc., everyone has always said, including that Christopher Steele, the bloke who worked for MI6 way back, and
the Steele report.
The Steele report. He said they've got compromising material, and everybody said yes, probably. We couldn't find out what it was. That maybe this is all true, and that this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with this massive, massive Putin sting.
See, I think 3 years ago, if you'd have said that, I've said you're a conspiracy theorist.
I think I might have said it about myself, but now I'm wondering.
Yeah, I have spent my whole career kind of convinced that conspiracy theories are total BS and that cock-up is always the much better explanation than conspiracy. And here you have now us having a serious conversation about this. And you think, well, did Epstein kill himself in prison or was he murdered? You know, oh, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, all the cast of characters that were involved.
Have you ever believed that Epstein took his own life in prison? Because I never have.
Are we really doing this? Are we having this conversation?
Exactly.
So I was
the BBC's North America editor at the time of the 2020 election. And you were hearing all this QAnon stuff. And I was thinking, oh, this is demented. This is bonkers. What, that there's a paedophile ring of rich and powerful people who are going to an island? Oh, it's true. There was a paedophile. And so this is just like heaven for the conspiracy theorist. I suspect, I'm clinging on by a thread to a sort of another explanation, that, you know, I think there are all sorts of people who knew what Epstein was up to. Because the other, you know, agency that you've heard associated with all this is Mossad, you know, the Israeli secret service. And so you pick your secret service and they are all kind of trying to compromise various people. And the cast of characters is just so improbable.
Can you believe, you know, you're saying this, though?
Like, no, I can't. It's the whole thing is unfathomable. But, you know, you've got Bill Gates, Noam Chomsky, Larry Summers, Peter Mandelson, Prince Andrew, it goes on. And you just think they can't all be linked. They can't all have found themselves. And how did they, you know, how did Bill Gates, who was then the richest man in the world, how did he find himself kind of in that circle?
There's a word I want to inject into this conversation. Can I say Trump?
All the time I was in America, I tried various theories and explanations that would account for his extraordinarily sympathetic, rose-tinted view of Vladimir Putin. And so one explanation that, you know, I was willing to entertain was Trump just loves a tough guy. He loves a hard man. He loves the tyrannical boss who everyone is frightened of. And Vladimir Putin fulfills that role brilliantly. Someone else who was a former ambassador in Washington who got to know Trump well said to me, no, no, you've got it wrong. It is Trump is a man of his generation. He's nearly 80 years old, grew up in the shadow of World War II, the threat of nuclear annihilation. He thinks Russia is a superpower that could endanger the world with its nuclear weapons and its fear of another nuclear war that drives Trump. And that explains it. And I think, well, that explains a bit of it, but it doesn't explain it all. The idea of kompromat is the theory that explains everything. That this is what could explain why he has taken such a ludicrously one-sided view over Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And his sort of almost, I'm seeing no evil, I'm hearing no evil about Vladimir Putin. He's a man of honor. He wants peace and he's doing his best to get it. And you think, really? Really? Can you explain all those missiles and drones going into Ukraine and knocking out the power supply when it's minus 20 degrees there and people are freezing to death? This is the man of peace? Are you kidding me?
But hang on. What possible piece of compromise could be so embarrassing for this man?
Oh,
like,
Hamish,
the thing about Donald Trump is that he...
Let's not go there.
But he has no shame, right?
So he has no shame, but... Look, there was a long period in the 1980s when American banks wouldn't lend to Donald Trump because there was such a fear of bankruptcy. And it was the Russian banks who took a stake in it. The other thing about kompromat, I mean, do I believe there is a videotape locked in a safe in the Kremlin that shows Donald Trump and two hookers urinating on a mattress that Barack Obama once slept in? I don't. I think the PP tape doesn't exist.
Just for listeners, that's what's included in the Christopher Steele report. That's not your imagination.
No, that was what was alleged in the dodgy dossier in 2016 that Christopher Steele, a former MI6 officer, was responsible for pulling together. So I don't believe that's true. But if they've got fear of kompromat, I mean, I don't understand what it is that could frighten Donald Trump so much. I don't believe that. I can't believe it. I cannot believe that Donald Trump is a kind of Russian sleeper cell that has been activated and ended up as the president of the United States. And a lot of the allegations about Trump in relation to Epstein, it does look like the relationship was broken off in the early 2000s. I still cling to the belief that it is not a conspiracy theory, but it is just, I cannot... You know, what is the door that opens that suddenly you enter a world of Epstein and the Lolita Express and underage girls? And if you're rich and powerful, aren't you absolutely terrified of exactly what is happening now could happen if you go there? And this is the bit that, what madness was it that possessed people to go into this space?
Well, that is the question, isn't it?
So how does someone like Bill Gates then get involved? Because he says, I never went to the island, I had some dinners, but then there's stories about him, well, included in these files, an STI.
Yeah, which he's denied.
And his wife giving this extraordinary interview in which she says, I'm pleased to be away from that muck.
I know. And, you know, I've interviewed Bill Gates a couple of times and always regarded because of the work that he's done on the eradication of polio in Africa, and polio was something my mother had suffered from. It's a hideous disease. And I always thought he was a hero figure. You know, yeah, he's a multi-billionaire, but what a philanthrop and all the rest of it. And you think, what are you doing there with Epstein? And I think the key to a lot of this is if we could find out how Epstein had made his money, because there has been no satisfactory explanation of how he came to be so rich.
And Donald Tusk, actually, specifically, I think in The Telegraph, he suggests that that original money could have come from the Russians, that he was doing deals with the Russians, because it's quite true. We don't know how Epstein's funds were set up. Mm. And I'm just reading my notes again. There are 10,000 references to Moscow in the files and 1,056 mentions of Putin itself. So, I mean, maybe that there is something in that man who became a sort of whisperer to the rich and powerful men in particular in ways that you wonder, was everything up for grabs? Like, question? I think that's what we're all wrestling with. Was everything up for grabs, a la our conversation about Mandelson? Or were there clear boundaries that are about prudence and duty? I mean, you know, we don't normally talk like this, but these are valid questions, I think.
They are, and we don't know the answers to them. I've spoken to people who've been really, really close to Mandelson and who've been with his political career from the very beginning about what is the driver for him to send confidential cabinet papers to Epstein. You know, was it about money? Was it, you know, Peter loved money, but he didn't have any of it, and therefore through Epstein he could get some? And they're saying, no, it's not. They're saying it's more pathetic than that. They're saying that it's approbation. It's Peter Mandelson looking for somebody who will say, God, you really are the center of the universe. You're so clever. You're so well connected. You are this phenomenal man. And thanks for all that information. But you must know that this is wrong, that this is highly sensitive data about, you know, potential asset sales and how that could enrich some of Epstein's clients. You know, we used to worry about the Masons and this secret societies. And here we have a secret society of Epstein's little world. But rather than them all enriching each other, which is what the kind of broad idea, I think, of the Masons was, that they would all look out for each other, it's all about giving Epstein even more power, whether in terms of knowledge, whether in terms of his ability to blackmail you, because he's got photographs, you know, of Andrew with his arm round Virginia Giuffre, even though Prince Andrew, you know, still tries to deny it. It's all about Epstein and the concentration of power.
I want to ask you something about that, though, because there's a bunch of Australian names that have been woven into this story this week. And of course, worth reminding listeners that just because a name appears in these files doesn't mean they're accused of anything, let alone guilty of it. And there's one particular period of Australian politics that gets mentioned in this latest tranche, but it involves Peter Mandelson. And I guess I don't get why this is all happening. Like, it's alarming to see it in print, but I don't understand what the interest is for Peter Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein and why they'd even be looking at Australian politics. So during a period where there was a campaign against Kevin Rudd and the proposed mining tax, the documents showed that Mandelson was writing to Epstein and basically saying that they needed to campaign against this resources super profit tax that was proposed here and was kind of giving almost guidance on how companies, including Xstrata, the big multinational miner, might approach this. Like, why are they talking about that?
Because they think that they're the, you know, the all-powerful, all-conquering global leaders, that they don't just care about what's happening in their own countries. They have to dabble elsewhere. If you are a bank like JP Morgan, and one of the people whose career has ended as a result of his relationship with Epstein is Jez Staley, who used to, you know, be a very senior figure in JP Morgan and then became head of Barclays Bank. You know, they have got global financial interests. And so they think that they operate on it. They, you know, bestride the globe.
I think this will have quite significant ramifications. It'll flow for quite a while as people come to wonder whether there is this ghastly sort of club of rich and powerful people who don't pay any price for anything.
Well, if you look at, let's just look at the simple terms of accountability. For this, the only person in prison is a woman, is Ghislaine Maxwell. And I'm not saying that she should not be in prison. I think she's played a very you know, major role in all of this, and, you know, was found guilty by, you know, 12 of her peers in a courtroom in New York, and is serving a prison sentence. Although very interesting why she's been put into a much more gentle, lower security prison by the Trump administration. And, you know, whether there's some, I mean, again, if you want a conspiracy theory, how is it that she's got a sweetheart deal from Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general? Does she know stuff that she won't reveal in return for getting less harsh treatment? I just ask the question. Again, it is so ripe for conspiracy theory. I think it is deeply, deeply troubling that there are elites, that there are power brokers. I guess we've always known in politics that there are people who wield influence disproportionately to their standing as non-elected bankers or whatever it happens to be, or financiers. We've sort of known about, but I don't think we've ever seen it as starkly as this, and the opacity with which these people operate, where you don't, but for the release of these FBI files and the jaw-dropping details that have shown people's involvement in matters that they should not be involved in, where they're wielding improper influence, I think does leave us ordinary Joes, the voters in election, who are asked to buy the manifesto of this one or that one, it just leaves a terrible smell. And I think that the rise of populist politics, which you've got in Australia, which we've got in Britain, which is across Europe, which is now rampant in America, is because there is a feeling that conventional politics has let you down, that the main parties have let you down. And you're seeing this played out in the Epstein files, where conventional politics and politicians looks grubby, dirty, it's male, it's entirely male, that all these people are there, they are swigging the champagne, they're with these underage girls, is grotesque.
Isn't this precisely part of the reason that the MAGA base voted for Trump?
Yeah. Well, Donald Trump's great cry was, you know, in 2016, drain the swamp. Drain the swamp. I heard it at rally after rally after rally. And then you find him in power, and Pam Bondi, his attorney general, looks at the Epstein files and thinks, whoa, are you sure you want these to come out? And suddenly Donald Trump is the swamp, you know, and they are part of the swamp. And that is the bit that I think that is going to kind of, you know, Donald Trump's first real pushback since his second term was over this. He didn't want the files to be released. And you saw him being so rude to a CNN reporter the other day when she dared to ask about the Epstein files. You know, he's saying it's time we all move on from this. Well, there are an awful lot of people who have not had justice. And I hope they carry on making a hue and cry until they get some form of justice and the people in power are made to pay a price for it.
John Sopel, you've taken us on quite a journey.
Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Pleasure.
Okay, well, we'll be back Monday with Global Roaming, Your Call at 11 and 9 on Radio National. You can find us in your podcast feed, global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. You can send all of your conspiracy theories to Geraldine too. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.